spanning the nerd world and feeding your fandom.
Crash landed.
From comics to video games.
From the cinematic universe to television.
This is Earth.
Connecting you to the biggest stars in the industry.
Something out there had discovered us.
It's time for the Down and Nerdy Podcast. Here's your host, James Witham.
The biggest weekend geekdom is finally here. It's episode 223 of the Down and Nerdy Podcast. I'm James Witham, and the real reason I'm talking so softly is because it's the wee hours of the night here at San Diego Comic-Con 2018. I'm at the hotel room here in San Diego trying not to wake up my neighbors, but I still wanted to bring you the show this week because it's the first of our two-parter for San Diego Comic-Con. So this is going to cover Wednesday and Thursday. Next week's show going to cover everything else. But got some great guests for you this week. Sam Humphries is going to join me to talk about a brand new Image Comics series that he has coming up called Blackbird and some other stuff. Then we're going to talk to Stern Pinball, yes, once again, from San Diego Comic-Con. We talked to them last year. This time we're going to talk to Director of Marketing and Pinball Wizard himself, Zach Sharp, about what's going on with Stern and what they have going on at the con if you're still here. And also, going to round things out with the Infidel creative team from Image Comics, Pornsek Pichichot, Aaron Campbell, and even Jose Valarubia, colorist and editor, joins me as well to talk about that book. There's so much to get to. Going to be talking about some nerd news and trailers as well. But up next, let's talk to Sam Humphries. It's what we're reading on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
This is Jody LaHoop, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
San Diego Comic-Con 2018. One of the things I love about coming here is getting to hang out with great guys like this. It's a name you'll remember from a show long ago. It's writer Sam Humphries. Sam, what's up, buddy?
Hey, I'm chilling. How you doing?
Pretty good, man.
I thought you're like hanging out here at the show. Like, we're not in a sterile white room in the middle of the Image booth.
Well, at least the lights are on in here.
That's
the one
true.
I did before, the
oh,
lights
really?
Weren't on at all.
There were no lights?
Oh, well, it was talking about Infidel, so it had to be creepy.
Oh, I mean, of course.
It makes
yeah,
sense.
Yeah.
Keeping the family.
I mean, I wish we were, like, having beers back here, but
you know,
it is, like, before noon for another 15
for
minutes.
Before noon on the West Coast.
That's right. Oh, good call. Good call. Where are you located at?
I'm on the East Coast. I'm in Virginia, so
okay.
It would be a lot later, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, you've been working with a lot of licensed properties and characters lately.
Sure,
what's it like to kind of do something more creator-owned like Blackbird and get into things with Image?
I mean, it's great. I love developing new stuff. I love working with existing properties. I also announced a new creator-owned book yesterday.
Yes, you did. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Goliath Girls.
Yeah, looking forward to that on Comixology.
It's already out. You don't have to look forward to it. It's already available.
Well, see, but I have it ready.
Oh, gotcha.
So I have to look forward to
that's
it
right.
at some point. But,
you look
I mean,
to
you
it
guys go get it
hours.
Now.
Exactly. It's available on Comixology and Amazon. And we made history with the book. Goliath Girls is the very first English language comic to be translated and published simultaneously in Japan.
Wow.
We've had that with comics coming from Japan. But this is the first time we're bridging the gap in the other direction.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice.
So I love doing both. Blackbird has been a fantastic experience in developing a concept from scratch between myself and co-creator Jen Bartel. The book is the ideas, the characters, everything about it came out of conversations we had together.
Awesome. Now, I mean, when it was first announced, Blackbird was described as Harry Potter meets Riverdale.
Oh, it's still described that way.
Which is
it's
really
still
cool.
accurate. Yeah.
All right, well, then let's dive a little deeper into that. If that's the case, then let's take Nina, for example.
Okay.
What would you say she is a cross between of those two worlds? If you could pick two characters from those two worlds, what is she a cross between?
She's probably, you know, our previous not as good tagline for describing the book was Harry Potter for people who can get into a bar. So either you're drinking age or you're crafty enough to get a
there
fake ID.
There you go.
Yeah. So it's a lot of, you know, in the broad strokes, there's a lot of things that Harry Potter is. It's coming of age story, it's magic, it's just finding a place for yourself in the world, all that kind of stuff. But you know, we also wanted a lot of hot people kissing. You know,
that doesn't hurt.
We wanted slightly older characters trying to make it in the world. You know, like
nice.
Early 20s, like what it's like to try and figure out what your place is going to be, all that kind of stuff. So that's what the overlap is between those two books.
Now, I mean, when I think of beautiful people and three-eyed cats, I mean, how can you not think of Jen Bartel?
Of course, right?
I mean, that just goes without saying. Now, you actually said at Image Expo that Blackbird is a book that could only exist when you guys collaborate.
Absolutely. It's only a book that could exist in the Venn diagram between myself and Jen. And that's because this book did not exist before we started talking together. This was a fresh idea that came out of discussions that we had when we were just friends talking about what we loved about comics, what we wanted to see more of in comics, what we wanted to see at all in comics. And those conversations evolved until, before we knew it, we were talking about a book, doing a book together. And I said, well, Jen, what do you want to draw? And she was talking about magic and spectacle, you know, big magical spectacles and demons and spirits and all that kind of stuff. She's talking about neon-drenched cityscapes. She was talking about beautiful people flirting with each other. And, you know, like, and we're talking, and it's all, like, coming together in my head. And I was like, damn, like, this is a comic I would buy, much less write, you know what I mean? And that's why Blackbird is the way it is. That's why it is beautiful people and three-eyed cats, because this book only exists with the two of us together.
Now, you guys actually decided to set the book in L.A., so that seems like an obvious choice, but oftentimes the cities become characters themselves in the stories. Is that the case with Blackbird?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's an obvious choice because it's the second biggest city in America, but Jen was born there. I live there, so we both have a strong connection to the city, and it's... We have a whole history of magic in this book that goes back 1,000 years, and there's a lot of specific reasons why magic has flourished in Los Angeles and not other places, why it's flourished the way it has in Los Angeles and other places. A lot of Los Angeles history has informed the backstory of Blackbird, whether it's the aqueduct bringing water to Los Angeles, or the gangs versus LAPD in the 40s and the 50s, a studio system of Hollywood. All those things really come into play, and then we've also figured out the ways in which magic has influenced and deformed the history of Los Angeles.
Now,
and then on top of that, there's just so much beautiful things in Los Angeles to draw. Beautiful things in our eyes, you know?
Right.
Like alleyways, neon-drenched cityscapes, you know what I mean? Like, we're not showing you Los Angeles you've seen a million times in postcards. We're, like, digging deep.
Nice.
Nina lives in North Hollywood. There's a lot of, like, landmarks that we're playing with in North Hollywood that a lot of people who don't live there may have never seen before.
Now, Sam, I know you're busy, so before I let you go, I wanted to give you one more here. We already know, even before reading issue one, is that Nina does know that magic does exist, that that's going to be a part of it. So, I mean, it'd be easy for me to ask you something like, you know, what would you do if magic existed?
Right.
Let's do something different.
Okay.
What's the last thing you would want to see someone do if magic existed?
The last thing I would want somebody to do with magic?
Yeah, like, what's the worst thing you could possibly think of?
The worst thing I could possibly think of? Oh, man. I don't know. That's a long list. I mean, the worst thing, I don't know, would probably be to, like, erase everybody's free will or something like that.
Oh,
that sounds pretty terrible.
That is pretty terrible.
Yeah, but maybe something like, you know, I would not want them to make every piece of pizza ever taste like a fart.
Oh, man.
No,
that's
no
just,
pizza fart curse.
No,
please.
No, we can't have that. No, no.
Wizards, if you're listening to me right now, anything, do anything else, but please don't ruin pizza for everyone for eternity.
That would be terrible. And that would also be the worst Oreo flavor ever. So hopefully.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
if you are one of those crazy developers at Oreo right now, at Nabisco or whatever,
don't do it.
Do not. Just stop. Don't even think about it.
Don't
do
it.
Come on.
No, not at all.
Yes.
But, I mean, we're definitely looking forward to Blackbird. Issue 1 is going to be available this October at local
October 4th.
There you go. More specific. October 4th.
Yeah.
Get that at your local shops or digital retailers, of course.
Yes.
Sam Humphries, thanks so much.
Hey,
thanks so much, man.
It's been great to be back.
As if that wasn't enough, going to be talking about pinball with Stern Pinball Director of Marketing Zach Sharp. It's up next on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
Hey, what's up? This is writer Sam Humphries, and you are listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
This is kind of becoming a yearly tradition for us here at San Diego Comic-Con 2018, talking with Stern Pinball Director of Marketing Zach Sharp. Zach, what's up, buddy?
How are you doing?
Pretty good. Now, I asked Gary this last year, and I want to ask you this, get your take on it. So, what do you think it is in a world of devices, and everybody's got their phones and tablets out? What is it about pinball that just makes it stand the test of time over so many years and decades?
You'll have to let me know if this sounds eerily like Gary, or if it sounds like my own unique
answer.
Okay, all
right.
But pinball is something that can't be replicated. It is a physical, interactive entertainment device. You know, a video game, something on your phone, while it's fun, it can be replicated versus pinball. It's something unique and fresh every single time you step up to it. So it's something that just can't be duplicated.
And for me, I think it's that I'm competitive with myself anyway, and do you think that kind of grabs people too? And all of a sudden, they're like, "Oh, I'm not letting that ball fall down the hole again."
I mean, you're battling geometry, you're battling gravity, and while gravity will always win, it's what you make in those moments where you have fun.
And I've heard you're quite the pinball wizard yourself. So how did you get so good?
You know, I have my moments. I've been playing for a long time, since pretty much birth. And I've grown up around pinball machines and have enjoyed playing ever since. And now it's my job.
If that's the case, then what was your first machine? I know you remember.
The first machine I bought was a 1986 Bally Cybernaut.
Nice.
First game I grew up around, I couldn't even tell you. My dad's owned pinball machines my entire life, so I've grown up with 5, 10, 15 machines in the house all throughout the years.
So if you stop by the Stern booth, which is 501 here at San Diego Comic-Con, not only are you going to see the new Iron Maiden game that you guys have over there, which looks amazing, you guys are actually selling CDs and stuff too. So what is it about rock and roll and pinball that goes so well together?
It's just high energy. I mean, pinball, music, I mean, you can't beat that combination. But we also have games in the Star Wars booth, so people who are big Star Wars fans go to the Star Wars booth, and we have even more games in the pinball lounge.
Do you get requests for certain properties or certain stuff? Like, you get to make this a pinball machine. Is there anything, what's the most popular request that you usually get?
You know what, every licensor is different. Sometimes we go after them for a game, and other times they come to us. We recently did this private label game, Supreme. I don't know if you've heard of the brand, but I mean, they're highly popular. They had a video released over 2 million views in a day.
Wow.
They sell a brick with their logo on it for $300. A brick that you can get for $5, they sell for $300.
It almost sounds like the destroyed jeans that you can get with
yes.
Like two like things of denim there, and they're like, these are $200.
But they wanted Stern to make a unique pinball machine for them, and they sold out in, I think they clocked it at 9 seconds on their website.
You're kidding, 9 seconds?
Yeah. And they've been reselled on a secondhand market. There was one machine that went for $65,000.
I think 9 seconds is probably my worst pinball game ever. Now I think about it, I think that probably sums it up about right. So you guys have actually got a tournament that's going on again at San Diego Comic-Con this year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so at the Pinball Lounge every day, if you stop by, we're going to be running a daily high score tournament, and there'll be prizes, giveaways, live streaming of some of the tournament games, and just a lot of fun. So stop on by, meet us, play. Play more pinball.
And you guys don't just do the big machines either. You do some apps and stuff too, right?
Yeah, so we have the Stern Pinball Arcade, which is free to download on your phone, and you can purchase more tables. So if you can't afford or you don't have the physical space for, you know, a terrestrial machine, you can play the virtual game, and you can learn all the rules. It's the exact same representation of what you'd find out in the wild, but in a digital format.
Before I let you go, Zach, I need to know, what's your dream machine? What's someday something you hope to see the Stern Pinball name attached to? What do you want to get?
You know, I'm under a strict NDA. Who's to say that we're not working on it right now?
Look at this guy. Getting all coy over here.
There's my Gary answer.
That is a very Gary answer. Well, we'll be looking forward to it. What's the website again?
For sternpinball.com.
Just making sure that we got it right.
That's the same. There's a lot of websites out there.
You can even Google it if you like. Yeah. It's STERN for anybody that's looking for Stern Pinball. Yeah. Zach Sharp, Director of Marketing, thanks so much for taking the time.
Hey, thank you.
If you're still at the con, make sure you play a little bit of Stern Pinball while you're there. They even have the Star Wars machines that are by the LucasArts booth as well at San Diego Comic-Con. So if you're still at the con, go ahead and go check that out. Of course, you can always find them online and on social media as well. That's going to do it for this week in Geektainment. Up next, a whole bunch of trailers to talk about nerd news. We'll do it on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
This is Lexa Doig from Arrow, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
Who says nothing can happen on Wednesday and Thursday at San Diego Comic-Con? It is time for nerd news, and I'm going to run through these trailers really, really quickly, because I'm sure that you've already seen them on YouTube. Let's start with Titans, and you want to talk about a show that's gritty and dark, especially for Teen Titans. This show is friggin' dark. Yeah, we get an F-bomb dropped in there, but I'm not going to lose my mind over that. I'm also not going to lose my mind about how rough that Robin was with the bad guys, where Dick Grayson, he's clearly pissed about something, and he's got some anger issues that I don't know what's going on there, but again, this is the first trailer. We're going to find that out at some point, but it seemed like the trailer itself really focused on Robin and Raven and how Raven seeks him out to find out, you know, hey, what exactly is going on with me? And then you don't really see where the other Titans come in necessarily, but we do get to see them. We get to see a little bit of Beast Boy, a little bit of Starfire, a little bit of Hawk and Dove. So we get to see pretty much everybody in this, but we don't really see how they come together. And I don't think that's necessarily something that we needed in a first trailer. But I mean, Geoff Johns teased the fact that, I mean, Superboy could become involved in this show at some point. Lex Luthor, it seems like the sky's the limit. He said the whole Titans universe is up for grabs. That's a big list. I'm not sure if Deathstroke's still going to be on that list, but that's a pretty big friggin' list if you ask me. So again, I think as far as first looks go, this one really, really knocks it out of the park, and I can't wait to actually see the first episode of Titans. And again, I'm not really hung up on any of the kind of overly intense stuff. I mean, just because you see a little bit of blood and some guy getting beaten down doesn't necessarily mean that the guy's dead, right? So we have to keep these kinds of things in mind. Can't wait for Titans. Another one that I can't wait for, real honestly, and as someone who's not a huge Doctor Who fan, and I know that that's a mark against me, go ahead, tweet me and, you know, tell me you hate me, all this other stuff. But I really am looking forward to this next season of Doctor Who. And the female Doctor, Jodie Whittaker, I got to tell you, she really brings a lot of charm into this. And a charm to Doctor Who that I don't think we've seen on this level for a long, long time. And it just looks like it's going to be fun. And it's going to explore different settings and different groups of characters. And the group dynamic, even though we saw it for, what, like 45 seconds, looks like it's really, really good. So, I mean, I like the fact that it seems like it's going to be a lighthearted fun, but there's still going to be plenty of action as well. This is the first time we actually get to see a little bit of action from the show's first look. So, I mean, I'm down for this. This is actually a time where I'm going to sit down and give Doctor Who an honest chance this time around and see if I'm going to be hooked. And I got to tell you, from what I've seen, if this is what they're going to do, this is definitely a show that I will start watching on a more regular basis. Here's something you can start watching on a more regular basis, because it's going to be coming to the Disney streaming service. And who knew that Star Wars Clone Wars, when they had their panel at San Diego Comic-Con, was going to be announcing a return for a seventh season? Yes, hashtag Clone Wars saved is what they had up there. And, you know, it started, you know, the trailer started out innocently enough. We had some clone trooper helmets, and we had some voiceovers of lines from previous episodes of the show. And then we get a little bit of something where you see Anakin and Obi-Wan and trying to find out why they're being summoned. And turns out that, I'm not going to spoil this. I know that it really doesn't matter in the grand scheme of things, but I just won't say it. I will tell you that someone's alive that we didn't think was alive, and that's really what we're dealing with here. So, and again, it's been, what, 5 years since we've had any Clone Wars at all, and now we don't really have a firm release date on this, because we don't have a firm release date for the Disney streaming service anyway. But just the fact that we know it's coming is one of those things where it's like, okay, so Disney needed something to make a statement after everything that's been going on with DC Universe. I mean, say what you want, but DC Universe has ruled the headlines of streaming services other than Netflix recently, and there's been a lot of good stuff coming from streaming services. But, I mean, DC Universe hasn't even put anything out yet, and they're still getting a lot of attention. So, I mean, you needed to do this if you were Disney. And we'll talk about price points here in just a second. But really quickly, I wanted to go through some other trailers as well. Congratulations to the cast of Impulse, going to be getting a second season in 2019. We got a little bit of a teaser there. Nothing super, super new, but we do get to see that Henry's more in control of her powers, and it looks like she might actually get some answers as to what's going on with her at some point. But again, not a whole lot of new footage, if any, if you really want to say that. But it certainly doesn't look like her life's going to get any easier. I'm not sure if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But the one that really interests me is Origin, because it's one of those stories where, you know, it's not like this hasn't been done before. You know, like, what if you could start your life over sort of thing. This has been done in movies and in TV, but it looks like we're going to find out why these characters want these new lives. It's a choice that you make, and that's the interesting thing here, is that it's almost the power of choice. It's not like, or at least it doesn't look like from the trailer, that they were kidnapped, thrown in these pods, and thrown on a spaceship and decided to be shipped off to a world that's just recently been colonized sort of thing. No, this is a choice. So is it because they're running from something? Is it because they just want to forget something? And that's why the characters are going to make all the difference in this, and how that bears itself out. How interesting are these characters going to be? Because if they're not interesting, there's no show. But if you can give me good depth of the characters without 1,000 flashbacks, then I think we've really, really got something to talk about here. So I'm looking forward to what they're going to be able to do with Origins this fall. I think it could be really, really neat. I want to stick with the streaming services, though, and talk about really quickly Iron Fist, because there was this different stuff that was released to the public and that was released at the panel. So what you've already seen on YouTube is you see Danny Rand saying, "This is my city, I'm going to defend it," sort of thing. Sort of like the Kevin McAllister of New York, "This is my house, I have to defend it." And that's exactly what he's going to do. And you see him beat a few dudes down. There's nothing earth-shattering except for him punching the ground. I mean, I guess that's kind of earth-shattering, right? So there's nothing that would really make you say, wow, other than the fact that we know that it's coming out September 7th now. At the panel itself, it looks like we got a little bit of the classic costume that was revealed. Not sure how much of a part that's going to play in this upcoming season. If any, maybe it's just a little bit of a teaser. We know that Typhoid Mary is going to be coming as well. And let's face it, Finn Jones has really just become more comfortable in the role of Iron Fist and Danny Rand. It seems like every time we see Danny Rand on screen now, it's better and better. First, it was Defenders, where I was like, huh, I guess Iron Fist isn't so bad. And then it was Luke Cage. I was like, wow, that was one of the best episodes of Luke Cage, the one where they had Iron Fist, and they were playing off of each other so well, which is going to happen again in Iron Fist Season 2, it sounds like. So, I mean, I didn't think I would say this after the way the first season went, but I'm excited for Iron Fist Season 2. I'm not exactly sure where it's going to go yet, but I'm excited to see how they're going to be able to explore what's going to be coming next, and how much is Kun Lun going to be involved. And this is, well, you'd think a pretty good amount, but only time will tell. Going to talk about one more trailer before we move on, and that's for Night Flyers, which is on Sci-Fi. Now, I remember the first look that we kind of got at that. It seemed like it was going to be a kind of gory, gritty, horror type of deal. Well, this look actually gives us more on the characters themselves, and you see that they have family ties and ambitions, and we get to finally find out, okay, these are people, and they're doing this for a reason, and the reason being is that there's a threat to mankind itself, so they're going to go up in the Night Flyer and see if they can figure out what's going on and solve this whole mess. But speaking of mess, that's exactly what it turns into, is a giant mess. So, and again, you don't really get a whole lot from the trailer, although I was in the press room for Night Flyers, and they were talking about it being very much a psychological sci-fi thriller, and there are going to be some horror elements and jump scares in there, but not a ton. And it is based on the novella from George R.R. Martin, so if you've read that, you already know kind of that, maybe this is a little bit of a spoiler, that aliens are coming. Not like aliens is in the movie, but aliens themselves are coming, but not necessarily too soon, according to the producers from Night Flyers. But we'll have that whole coverage from the Night Flyers press room coming up on a future show. But it's definitely, the second trailer definitely made me more interested in watching Night Flyers than the first one did, and I think that that's a good thing. Really quickly, since you've probably already seen it, I do want to run through the DC Universe price point news really, really quickly. You already know what's coming. You know, movies, TV shows, comics, a whole bunch of different stuff that you can do with DC Universe. The year-long subscription, if you pre-order, which I'm not sure if it's just this weekend or if it's going to be extended a little bit past that, but it's going to be $74.99 plus tax when you pre-order. Now, the monthly price is going to be $7.99. We also know that now a Stargirl live-action series is going to be coming to DC Universe, according to Geoff Johns. The JSA is going to be involved. They're going to be co-starring. Could open the door for a JSA series at some point. So, yeah, we just get more and more stuff that gets added to the DC Universe streaming service. And I don't know what I quoted the price to be, what I thought it was going to be on a past show. If you want to go back and tell me what it was, I guarantee you it wasn't $7.99. I really don't think I went that low. I think I definitely went higher than that, especially with everything that you're getting. So, I mean, I think $7.99 is a bargain. I think $74.99 is even better because you're getting like 3 months free. And I'm not, you know, this is not an ad for DC Universe. It just sounds like a great deal to me. And as someone that's a DC fan, if you are, this is a good way to really absorb a ton of it. So, I mean, to me, it just seems like a no-brainer. So it'll be interesting to see what those initial numbers are, though. And if Disney looks at that when they're going to be starting their streaming service, which you know is going to be more expensive, and see exactly what they're going to do and what their price point's going to be. Couple more comic items from the DC realm that I wanted to talk about before we move on, and that's that Liam Sharp kind of leaked out the fact there's going to be a relaunch of Green Lantern. It's going to be involving Grant Morrison, who's going to be writing it, and I think that that's, first of all, a great powerhouse creative team to put on Green Lantern, and what they're going to do is they're going to kind of ditch the whole apocalyptic ending thing. They were talking about how we're not going to do 12 issues and then the world comes to an end sort of deal, or could come to an end. It's going to be like Hal Jordan's Space Cop. And I think that that's a neat way to go because, and there was nothing wrong with what Robert Venditti has been doing with Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps, but I think it's time to lighten the character up a bit, and to make him Hal Jordan's Space Cop, I think would be great. I think that was one of the beauty parts of Green Lanterns so often, was that it was so lighthearted, and it was so fun that, you know, why not try and do that same thing with Hal Jordan, who certainly had a history of that in his character as well. So I think this will be really, really neat. Another comic that we know is going to be coming in November is a Shazam comic, and it's going to be written by, yes, the great Geoff Johns himself, and Dale Eaglesham is going to be involved as well. Now, I mean, first of all, perfect timing for when the movie's going to be getting ready to come out. You definitely want to, you know, give Shazam a little bit of a spotlight there. But you put Geoff Johns on Shazam, and that tells you they're taking it very, very seriously. And I think, you know, Shazam kind of one of those underrated characters, isn't he? That you know that he's there, and you're happy when he shows up, but you never expect him to be a regular part of an ongoing series. But, I mean, if Plastic Man can get a book, and Gail Simone's done some fantastic things with that, then you've got a good shot that Geoff Johns is going to be able to do the same exact thing for Shazam. That's going to do it for Nerd News this week. Up next, yes, we're going to be talking to the creative team behind Infidel from Image Comics. That's next on the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
This is writer Christopher Sabella, and you're listening to the Down and Nerdy Podcast.
San Diego Comic-Con 2018. It's so nice to sit in a dark room with these fine gentlemen. It's writer Pornsack Pichichot from Infidel, of course, Aaron Campbell, the artist, and we have a surprise, Jose Valerubia, the colorist as well. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Colorist and editor, by the way.
And editor. Well, we got to get that in there.
Some light. I mean, there's light coming in from the... It doesn't reach us down here. It is light coming in.
I really feel like we're about to do a shady business deal
yes,
or something.
It's really true.
We'll do that off the air. Yeah, yeah. We don't want to reveal the details.
I am curious how much you're willing to pay me for this.
Now, during Image Expo, when the book was announced, you know, you go through, they send out the press release, and they say, here's the books that came out. This one stood out to me the most. So talk about what it was like to actually put this story together.
Oh, geez. I mean, I've had this story kicking in the back of my head for like the past 8 or 9 years. It's something I would noodle on the side during my time as a DC Vertigo editor and then working for DC Comics. And then when I decided to, go freelance and start writing, I really wanted, because the world was becoming what the world is now, I really wanted the book to come out, and it seemed like what the book was talking about was so pertinent to the world. And so I wanted to do it as a comic, And my first call was to my friend, Jose Villarubia, who, during our time at Vertigo, we worked together a lot. And my favorite game to play when I was working with Jose is to call Jose up and be like, hey, Jose, I got a new book greenlit. And this is what it's about. And this is the artist that I'm thinking of. And because Jose knows, like, everyone in comics. He knows all the artists in comics. He knows the artists in comics that you haven't, that haven't even, like, drawn anything yet. Like, they just know where they are and where they're going to pop up. So I'm like, Jose, who do you think should draw these books that I'm thinking about putting together? And it was my favorite game. And part of coming back to comics was the opportunity to give old friends a call and have an excuse to talk to them again. Because now that we're adults, that's what it takes to talk to old friends. You have to have work as an excuse to talk to them. And so we had that conversation, and I told him about the book, and I told him, you know, who do you think you should draw? Because this is who I'm thinking I should draw it. And Jose kind of came back to me with, like, you know, as you know, I've always wanted to be an editor. I'm a frustrated editor, so, like, I would love to edit this book. And I thought, like, that sounds so cool. And that was pretty much, we were off to the races from there. And then Jose brought Aaron on board, and I think, Jose, you can probably talk to how, you know, you thought of Aaron.
I thought we did a lot of thinking and a lot of back and forth. And, you know, Kornsack and I had a great friendship and a great professional relationship. One of the reasons why I wanted to do this was because Kornsack and I could always tell each other the truth of what we thought, and we could always agree to disagree. And we have a very respectful and very detailed way of looking at things. And I love his perfectionism, and I love his passion. And I love that I don't have to agree with him just to be nice, and he doesn't agree with me just to be nice. I had him as an editor for many years. So that's rare, because people have frail egos in the industry, and creative people are, you know, they take it personally, and he knows that I'm not that way, and I know that he's not that way. So we wanted to find an artist that was talented enough to do it, and that could actually, like, my main priority was that I don't find most comic books scary that are horror. I love so many of them, from Warren Comics on, from Easy Comics on, but I'm not scared when I read them. I've never been scared, even when I was little and I was reading them. They just don't scare me. There are very few that have. So I wanted an artist that wasn't only just a good storyteller, but with the chops to actually scare the reader. And that's something that took a lot of thinking from our part, and a lot of that. I also wanted somebody who was reliable, hardworking, nice, and not a prima donna. Because there's a lot of talented artists out there, many of which I'm very good friends with and I work with as a colorist.
We can't be perfect, yeah, right?
So I wanted somebody that temperamentally, just like Kornsack and I temperamentally agree with each other, not just artistically or creatively, somebody that would temperamentally fit the book. So if I was going to be editor, I didn't want to be an editor that pulls their hair in chunks because the person doesn't respond or whatever, which is something that all my friend editors go through on a regular basis. So Aaron came to mind as somebody that I've known for many, many years, who's been doing an amazing body of work, who really I thought could have much wider recognition in the industry if he had something that he could really sink his teeth into. And so we asked him, and he agreed right away, and the rest is history.
I mean, we'll get to the scary part of this book here in just a second.
And I want to piggyback on one thing that Jose said, too, because I think it's really to Jose's credit that Aaron has done a lot of horror, like, illustration sort of on his own, but his comics work up to that point, there wasn't any. And so it really is a testament to Jose's eye that I don't think I would have had a keen eye to see, that Jose could see the parts of what Aaron was doing in all his work and say, this guy really can draw scary. Even though he'd actually never, he hadn't had any published art that was actually horror art at that point. So I really have to give Jose credit for that, because I don't think I wouldn't necessarily have come to that conclusion based on the materials that I had at hand. And it really took an artist's eye to be able to see that.
Well, actually, you know, let's skip ahead to that then, because, I mean, I'm going to be honest, from the first issue, this book scared the hell out of me. And like Jose said, I don't get scared reading comics, ever. So, Aaron, talk about what it was like to kind of bring this world to life, and actually the way that Jose uses the colors as well to kind of change the mood and the setting of certain scenes.
Well, you know, it began with a basic idea of the otherworldliness that Kornsack wanted from the ghosts. And sort of the weirdness of the ghosts. And Jose wanted something that felt sort of preternatural, something that was almost photoreal, something that could almost feel completely like part of reality. And so from there, you know, I started kind of conceptualizing, and that's where I came up with this idea to kind of fragment my process, where I have a digital process combining with traditional process. I'd been doing digital for the past 2 years on, like, the previous thing I did was called was Felix Leiter at Dynamite, and that was completely digital, and I was kind of getting, feeling a little stale working completely digital. I wanted to do something that kind of expanded the realm of possibilities. So I had this idea that there could be an interesting analogy or metaphor in the process where you have the digital process, which is all reality. Everything in the real world around Aisha and Medina and her family and all of the things happening in the real life in the apartment building is digital. And then everything that's incorporeal or supernatural would be traditional. And so by traditional, I mean like painted, multimedia or mixed media, gouache, ink, colored pencil. I was even using bleach and all kinds of weird experimental techniques. Really looking to people like Bill Sienkiewicz and Dave McKean and Kent Williams and the classic guys from the heyday of Vertigo, you know, when they were really doing experimental stuff with their process. So the idea then was that the boundary line between the digital and the traditional process is the boundary that exists between, or that's created by bigotry and hate. It's the thing that keeps us separate. And so from there then I started thinking more about, well, how do we really want the ghosts to be? And my idea was ultimately, what if they appear as they would have looked in the exact final moment that they were alive? So when the tragedy strikes and everyone is on the the cataclysmic event is happening, there's this very small infinitesimal moment where the concussive force of this, you know, eruption is starting to tear their bodies apart, but there's still consciousness left. And then right before that consciousness snaps off is how they would appear. And then in addition to that, we started developing who these characters were in life, what it was about their character that caused their psyche to persist into this paranoia, hate-filled spirit, and then what aspects of those characters could I sort of build into the look of the ghosts that would sort of express those ideas. So each ghost, ended up becoming its own entity with its own characteristics to present those different ideas. And then it was just a matter of, like I was talking last night, it was a matter of doing very disturbing reference research.
For instance, I don't want to see your Google search history.
Weird tumors was one that I had to look up, and that was a very bad night.
Yeah. No, we're totally on a watch list for all the research.
That's a scary trip down Google Lane right there, let me tell you. Now, you mentioned Aisha, and I think one of the things that you guys did really well in the first issue right from the get was to make her such a likable character right away, introducing her to Chris and introducing the family and everything like that. But it was her eternal optimism that I think really grabbed me from the get-go. Now, would you say that is her greatest strength or her greatest weakness as the series?
You know what? I think that is the question of the series. You know, that is the question that the character is wrestling through, the reader should be questioning, that I'm certainly questioning, is optimism, is faith and idealism a strength or a weakness? And I don't know. I personally don't know where to land on that, except that, and it's kind of, you know, the direction that the book goes to is that if faith and idealism isn't the answer, I don't know if we've come up with a better one yet.
Yeah.
Is the direction the book is reaching towards, even though it questions it all along the way. And so that would be my answer. It's like, it's what Winston Churchill said about democracy, right? It's deeply flawed, but it's the best system we've got.
There you go.
You know?
Yeah, I would characterize it as all of those aspects of Aisha's character make her incredibly vulnerable, but then deeply resilient because of that. And so it's how she succumbs, but it's how she survives.
Now, the book, obviously, for the first several issues in this first arc, deals with some very, let's just say, uncomfortable at times subject matter. So when you were getting ready to put the book out, what did you think the first reactions would be, and how did you respond to when you actually got the first reactions from the book?
God, I'll be honest. I had no idea what the reaction for the book was going to be. I mean, so much of this was, it was talking from the place of this character. So much of this book is me just laying bare sort of my insecurities and my fears about the world and what the world may be, and if we are discovering the world is a different place than we think it is. And you put that out there, and you hope that people will go with you, but then you don't know. I mean, it's the world that we live in right now that seems like at every second things will just get worse. And somehow there's a left turn and something nice actually happens. So I don't know how so much of my faith in the world was built into my was into the book that I didn't, so much of that book is questioning if the world believes what the character believes and some of the things that I believe. And so as a result, I had no idea what the response of the book was going to be. So as a result, the important thing to me was just to be honest in terms of what the themes of the book and what the characters were feeling, and to give everyone's side of their story. We're talking about sort of the racism and xenophobia aspect, because it is good business to tell the most sensationalized versions of stories, we get the worst pictures of humanity surrounding us at all times.
True.
So, and that's the stuff we have easy access to. So then when talking about these stories, I wanted to tell the stories that we've seen a lot less, but at the same time still represents a spectrum of existence. The straw man of the straw man of the Trump supporter that lives in the Hicks and all that sort of stuff, like, that wasn't interesting to me, because that's, it is a straw man. But the kind of racism and xenophobia and institutional biases that I see in a liberal society like New York, that is more interesting, because it has more conflict, there's more ambiguity. And again, all that ambiguity and conflict, it lends itself very nicely to a horror story.
Now, one of the hardest moments of this entire 5-issue run was the confrontation between Tom and Medina.
Oh,
now, how do you feel? How did you guys feel about putting that together? And there's I don't know if you want to spoil it or not. I'll leave this up to you guys. There's a twist that happens at the end of that altercation that I did not see coming. What was it like to do that as well?
Ooh, I don't know if I should. I don't want to spoil the twist, because it hasn't been long enough.
But there's a nice little tease for anybody.
I think that twist was Aaron's idea. It was riffing off an idea I had. I think Aaron piggybacked off. We're not going to tell you what it is, but credit where credit's due. And that's one of the things I love about collaborating, is the fact that, like, you know you've got a good twist when you didn't see it coming. Like, when someone says, why don't we do this? I'm like, that's amazing. That totally sounds like the right answer. No one will see that coming, because I didn't even see it coming. So that's that. I think the thing, sometimes I worry, it's so funny, like, when you're starting these stories, you're so invested in the characters, and then once the shit starts hitting the fan, you almost have to sociopathically disconnect in order to let the people be what they are, and then you connect just long enough to sort of be in those characters in the scene. So, to me, that scene says a lot, right? Because it's a scene that says, this is the person who, you have the two people who are at the most on Aisha's side, fighting against each other very, very brutally. But I also like to think that we've seen that it doesn't come out of left field, because we've been prepping the reader for that aspect of Tom
right.
all throughout. And it is an interesting thing. It is this thing of, Tom is on the quote-unquote right side of things, for a good chunk of the book, but then you have to look at how he approaches it, right? With that sort of that fervor, that lack of empathy for the other side, that inability to sort of see what the other side thinks, and hopefully that's what makes that turn plausible, because you've seen that even though he believes what he should believe, he's got all the aspects of being someone that could be an antagonist, even though he believes what we agree he should believe in. And that, to me, was the important thing to explore in the context of that dynamic.
You talked about people's insecurities, and of course the book deals heavily with racism, mm-hmm. xenophobia, and stuff like that, but a lot of that stuff and Aaron, I wanted to talk to you about this. It's not addressed in words so much as it's addressed in body language and facial expressions.
Yeah.
And
very
Aaron,
much.
What was your process like actually drawing that out of some of these characters?
That's a hard one. It's always kind of intuitive, my process, and I work with models, you know, when I'm doing reference, so a lot of it happens in the acting, the actual literal acting process, where I'm directing the models in what they should be feeling, what they should be expressing, emoting, how they should be responding to what is essentially something that's not there. It's, you know, even whenever I have scenes with multiple characters, those are always shot independent of each other. So they're having, it's like doing everything green screen. And so, but yeah, a lot of that comes from, like, interesting body language. Like, for instance, Aisha, I actually use my niece as the model for Aisha. And one of my favorite moments is in the first issue where Leslie is talking about how she should teach Aisha her pork recipe that Tom loves so much. And Aisha is starting to get kind of uncomfortable because she doesn't want to say anything about her halal,
yeah.
You know, and then so she kind of starts to go inward on herself.
Yeah.
And that was sort of how I was working with my niece at the time, you know, basically explaining to her, you know, the way that you should be reacting. There's this woman that you're trying to create a incredibly, like a very tenuous relationship with, and you're trying to break through, and now she is, she's very happily, without any bias or hate in her heart, talking about how she should teach you this recipe because Tom loves it, but you can't express to her, you know, how you don't eat pork,
right?
And how, like, she, like, you can't find the words to deal with this and to do it in a way that will be diplomatic, and so you just start to kind of go into yourself as you get more and more withdrawn in your inability to express what you're feeling. And so that was a good example, and then suddenly Tom bursts in and,
right,
you know, everything erupts, you know, and he just makes it worse. So for me, it's always about trying to, like, get into the character's mind. And if I can ever draw upon personal experience, then I do that, and I try to express it through, you know, things that I have experienced or seen or whatever. So just like, I guess, like any other director would deal with actors in that regard. And then in terms of the ghosts, it's always about just this seed of hate that persists, and how they want to, especially in the beginning, how they want to violently impose their death upon Aisha. So when Aisha turns that corner in issue one and sees what we call the professor ghost, in my head I was thinking, he's not going to attack Aisha. He doesn't want to physically hurt her right now. He wants to violently expose her to his death and his torment. And so he stands there and forces her to watch him melt and die. And so those are the ways that I was kind of thinking. And as we go along with the book, it goes less from them wanting to expose Aisha to their existence to actually wanting to harm her physically, because it's just this steamroller, this snowball that's moving forward.
Right. Before I let you gentlemen go, and Jose, I'm actually glad you're here for this last question. Now, this book could really stand on its own as a 5-issue solid horror comic, but, I mean, there is a little bit of an open-ended ending there, so there's certainly room for more. So other than the film adaptation that we know is coming, congratulations to you guys on that.
Thank you.
Are we going to see more? And if we are, can you give us a little bit of a tease of what we could expect?
This will be the teasiest of teases. There is a door open for something else sort of in the world of this story. I have some vague ideas of what it will be. I don't think it will be anything like what people would think it's going to be, because it would, so much of the book involves what I personally believe in terms of, what I personally believe about the world that I see outside my window, and how I feel about it. So, to come back to this universe, this world, would involve either the world changing a great deal, which means things have gotten much worse very fast, or me changing a great deal, which generally doesn't happen. But that said, I couldn't approach it in exactly the same way. That said, though, I do have an idea of a potential way I could approach it. I could approach the ideas in there I think will be very different and not at all what people are thinking for the book. But I don't necessarily think people should be on the lookout for that there too soon. Although I could be wrong. The right circumstances could happen at this show, and all of a sudden, all the ideas would lock into place. But I do have some faint ideas of what the next thing could be. I think that it would be really cool. I don't think it would be anything at all what people would be expecting.
Well, luckily your editor is literally
right here.
So he's literally listening to this right now. And as a matter of fact, I mean, if you guys don't have the single issues yet, don't wait. Just go get the single issues of Infidel at your local comic shop. You can even do it digitally. Trade paperback, though, does hit on September the 26th.
Yes.
If you want to get that and see the amazing cover is the first thing that drew me to this book, too. So, I mean, just fantastic job. It's a Poinsack, Pichichote, Aaron Campbell, and Jose Valarubia. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me.
Yep, and I just want to plug real quick, the FOC for the trade, I think, is the middle of August. So if you're interested let your comic shops know, because they never ordered enough.
Absolutely.
Certainly didn't have the series. So definitely make sure.
<There you go. laughs>
Make sure they did with the trade.
Gentlemen, enjoy the con.
Thank you.
When I say that Infidel was not only great, but scared the living hell out of me, I really, really meant it. I don't really get uncomfortable or scared reading comics, but Infidel was one that I definitely did. You have to check it out. Single issues available right now. Gonna have to wait until September for the trade, though. I don't think you're going to want to wait, though. This is an Image Comics series you've got to be reading now. That's going to do it for this week's somewhat quieter edition of the Down and Nerdy Podcast, as I try not to wake my hotel neighbors here tonight. So make sure you're following us on social media at Down and Nerdy 757 on Twitter and on Instagram. A whole album of pictures actually up on our Facebook page, facebook.com/downandnerdy, and always get us at downandnerdypodcast.com. Whether you're at San Diego Comic-Con or wherever you are, you never have to apologize for being a nerd. So let your fan flag fly and be good to your fellow nerds.